Perhaps insects, with their different sense organs, have a very different universe, and that is an insect universe. This is, again, it seems to be a recrudescence of what used to be called the pathetic fallacy, which was the attribution of human qualities and emotions to natural phenomena. The wind sighs in the trees, and my heart is sad. And somebody comes along and says, it isn't the wind that's sighing, it's you. True and not true. Because you wouldn't be able to sigh if there were no wind. And you sighing and wind blowing go with each other. I've invented this new word, go with. G-O-W-I-T-H. Or goes with. It is to replace the idea of causality. Certain things go with each other. And sighing wind goes with a same world in which there are human hearts and human emotions. And if there were not a world with human hearts and emotions, there would be no wind. And if there were no wind, air, there would be no human hearts and emotions. It's a transaction. It's reciprocity. So, in the same way, every event, then, in the external world is as dependent on the observer for its happening as, for example, is a rainbow. You can say the sun is shining, and there's moisture in the atmosphere. And the sun, being at the right angle to the moisture, makes a rainbow. And if somebody is there, they see the rainbow. That is a mythology, a way of putting things that is acceptable to us in the current climate of philosophical and scientific fashion. But I want to put it in another way. The sun is shining, and there is a person standing. If there were moisture in the atmosphere, there would be a rainbow. But there isn't. So there is no rainbow. If you want to be fair, there is no rainbow if nobody is watching it. You see? As you must have one of the three components, sun, moisture, observer, to have the thing called rainbow. And what applies to the tenuous, filmy, luminescent rainbow applies equally well of the hardest rocks, the solidest mountains, and the hottest fires. Because all existence is a relationship. It's like the skin of the drum. If it's not there, it will no amount of hitting a non-existent skin will produce any noise. So you see, energy is, we can see this, energy is relationship. We can see the falling fist and the skin of the drum, boing, like that. And if there isn't both the falling fist and the skin, no noise, no existence. But existence is not only the impact of rocks upon each other. Existence requires, always as its third, you can get the rocks knocking. The sun and the moisture, the tree crashing to the ground, the sun pouring out electrical energy. But none of these things constitute existence until related with the neurological complex. But then you have to look backwards and say at the same time, the neurological complex belongs to the same world as the sun. It's a physical pattern, physical behavior, physical energy. But it takes this complexity of pattern to evoke the world. You see, this idea is unfamiliar. And that's the difficulty of understanding it. That's all. It's a very simple idea. But it's an unfamiliar one, and it's an unfashionable one. Although, as I say, this sort of thinking is coming back to us at this time. Very largely as a result of people's experiments with psychedelics, where one gets the perfectly uncanny feeling of the world and oneself as simply two phases of a single process. Well, as the rainbow metaphor illustrated, we arbitrarily favor an explanation of the triangle, the impact of energies in the external world, and an observer of this impact, which, as it were, energizes or realizes them, makes them real. The difficulty that we have in our prejudice that it's the two forces out there that are real and the observer is irrelevant to the reality of the situation. That's what we're really saying. It goes back to the whole notion that man himself is irrelevant. Man is conceived as something, therefore, that is irrelevant in various ways. He could be said to be irrelevant because he is a spiritual visitor from another world altogether. He could be said to be irrelevant because he's unimportant. He makes very little difference to the total universe. He's very small. But when you get this kind of thinking, you want to go back and ask, why do people want to believe that man is irrelevant? What in all theory of this kind, look for some ask the question, what do these people want to achieve by their theory, by holding the stance? And it was fashionable in the 19th century to look upon man as irrelevant for some very sound political reasons. I may sound a little bit like a Marxist in saying this, but it's when you're on the rampage, you have to believe either that you're the representative of God Almighty and doing everything at his bidding, or that what you're doing isn't really very important. Either position will give you an alibi for behaving like a barbarian. So the great put down on man, that our little affairs are of no concern to God, thank heaven he's not watching anymore. And we can get away with murder, which is what we wanted to do in the colonization doings, especially of the 19th century, and the outrages of the two world wars. There is no God watching anymore. You know, teacher has gone out, boys, let's raise hell. That was a way of getting rid of teacher. You know, God is dead, let's have a drink. And as a result of this, you see, it became so fashionable to think of man as a merely unimportant little victim of the cosmic trap that for a while Western man lost his sense of the dependence of the, what the Hebrews used to call, he lost his sense of man's position as the head of nature. And, when you hear today people's comments on that old myth of man as the head of nature, they come back in a very funny way. They say, oh, that's the most conceited point of view. Man is part of nature. Yes, but why is it that the naturalists who think that man is part of nature are always fighting nature? Because they don't understand what it means to be the head of nature. Every creature is the head of nature in its turn. And we all take turns, because it's taking turns that makes the world go round. Every creature in its turn is the head of nature, because each creature creates the world in its own image. And so each creature, as a creator of the world, is man. Man simply means the middle position. This is the whole idea of man, the middle way, the mean. And so, wherever is the central point, that is the point called man, just as you are the center of your universe. And as the astrologers explained, that when you wanted to draw the map of the soul, you took the center point occupied by the individual organism, in other words, a date, and a time, and that gave you a latitude and a longitude. And so in relation to that date and time, how was the universe arranged shows the map of the individual soul. Because the individual is the whole universe considered from this point of view, or focused at this point of view. So, in like way, the cosmic situation of a bee or a mouse puts that mouse in the position of man when the mouse is considered the center of the universe. Now, every point in a curved space-time continuum is the center of the universe. You can see it, although this is only a metaphor and is not quite the right mathematical and physical description. But when you consider the surface of a ball, of a sphere, any point on that surface can be the center. Just rotate it to what appears to be the front as you look at it, and it's the center of the surface of the sphere. Any point. So in that kind of, if our space is curved like the surface of a sphere, then any point on it may legitimately be considered the center. And so, considered as the center, that is the point called man. Although, as I say, it may be mouse, it may be ant, it may be insect, anything. But this becomes inconceivable and unimaginable to individuals who have no experience of themselves as center. And people who insist on the idea of being an objective observer, of standing outside and watching the individual, the world, as a kind of television screen or movie screen upon which there is a distant panorama of passing events. That person, by adopting that position, has excluded himself from the feeling of centrality. In fact, he rather looks down on the feeling of centrality. He says, that is the egotistic situation. You think you're the center of everything. But you know, you may call it all sorts of bad names. You may call it the egocentric predicament. But that's the way it is. And it's much less egocentric to accept it than to say, well, I'll go off and play my own eccentric game as an objective observer who is a sort of controller outside the world in that qualitative sense in which the monotheistic God is said to be outside the world. The boss. So then, if you take this to a very far extent, see how far we can go with it. Is it then that in the measure that you are the behavior of the universe, is the universe the behavior of you? I was talking at the beginning, you see, about the ease of understanding one way of looking at this and the difficulty of understanding the other, even though one implies the other. When we see that the degree to which individual behavior is a factor of the whole environmental scene, we tend to try and understand that in terms of determinism. That the individual organism is helplessly pushed around by and responding to environmental forces. But on the other hand, if the relationship between the organism and its environment is transactional, it won't be that one-sided. If the relationship is transactional, it will be true simultaneously that the individual organism behaves in accordance with the environment and the environment behaves in accordance with the individual organism. So if we put that in startling practical terms, if you got into a mess, that was what you wanted. Well, you say, I didn't know I wanted it. I certainly didn't think I wanted it. No, because that will be true. You didn't want it. So long as you refer to yourself only in terms of the conscious spotlight, which scans experience bit by bit and which thinks about it. To the degree you identify your own functioning with that alone, then you will say of what happens to you, well, I didn't ask for this. It has nothing to do with me. I wasn't responsible. But as soon as you extend your way of looking at things and are not that myopic about it, you'll begin to see what is, I think, clumsily foreshadowed by Freud and Jung, in especially Freud, in his idea of self-punitiveness, death wishes, and all these things, where he is trying to say of the unfunctioning of the unconscious that when you get into a catastrophe, you were accident-prone because you wanted to punish yourself. Now, actually, Grodek is much better at this than Freud. Very few people know Grodek. Grodek really was behind a lot of Freud's ideas. And he wrote a thing called the Book of the It. Das Buch vom Es. And in this he explains a most extraordinary theory of the unconscious, which he doesn't, like Freud. Freud basically didn't trust the unconscious. That's why he felt that the reality principle was in irreconcilable conflict with the pleasure principle, and that this conflict would destroy human civilization. Grodek, who looked like a goblin with enormous ears, the little man really looked like a goblin, and he ran a sanitarium at Baden-Baden where people who came for massage got psychoanalysis, and people who came for psychoanalysis got massage. Well, he wrote this book in the form of letters from a goblin